This is Audible.
Belinda Audio and Zaffa Publishing present this unabridged recording of The Tattooist of Auschwitz, written by Heather Morris and read by Richard Armitage.
To the memory of Lale Sokolov, thank you for trusting me to tell your and Gita's story.
Prologue.
Lale tries not to look up.
He reaches out to take the piece of paper being handed to him. He must transfer the numbers onto the girl who holds it. There is already a number there, but it has faded. He pushes the needle into her left arm, making a 3, trying to be gentle. Blood oozes, but the needle hasn't gone deep enough and he has to trace the number again.
She doesn't flinch at the pain Lale knows he's inflicting.
They've been warned. Say nothing, do nothing. He wipes away the blood and rubs green ink into the wound.
Hurry up,
Pepin whispers.
Lale is taking too long. Tattooing the arms of men is one thing. Defiling the bodies of young girls is horrifying. Glancing up, Lale sees a man in a white coat slowly walking up the row of girls. Every now and then he stops to inspect the face and body of a terrified young woman. Eventually he reaches Lale. While Lale holds the girl's arm as gently as he can, the man takes her face in his hand and turns it roughly this way and that. Lale looks up into the frightened eyes. Her lips move in readiness to speak. Lale squeezes her arm tightly to stop her.
She looks at him and he mouths, "Shh." The man in the white coat releases her face and walks away.
"Well done,"
he whispers as he sets about tattooing the remaining 4 digits, 4902. When he has finished, he holds onto her arm for a moment longer than necessary, looking again into her eyes. He forces a small smile. She returns a smaller one. Her eyes, however, dance before him. Looking into them, his heart seems simultaneously to stop and begin beating for the first time, pounding, almost threatening to burst out of his chest. He looks down at the ground and it sways beneath him. Another piece of paper is thrust at him.
"Hurry up, Lale,"
Pepin whispers urgently. When he looks up again, she is gone. Chapter 1, April 1942.
Lale rattles across the countryside, keeping his head up and himself to himself. The 24-year-old sees no point in getting to know the man beside him, who occasionally nods off against his shoulder. Lale doesn't push him away. He is just one among countless young men stuffed into wagons designed to transport livestock. Having been given no idea where they were headed, Lale dressed in his usual attire. A pressed suit, clean white shirt and tie. Always dressed to impress.
He tries to assess the dimensions of his confinement. The wagon is about 2.5 meters wide, but he can't see the end to gauge its length. He attempts to count the number of men on this journey with him. But with so many heads bobbing up and down, he eventually gives up. He doesn't know how many wagons there are. His back and legs ache. His face itches. The stubble reminds him that he hasn't bathed or shaved since he boarded 2 days ago. He's feeling less and less himself. When the men try to engage him in conversation, he responds with words of encouragement, trying to turn their fear into hope. "We stand in shit, but let us not drown in it." Abusive remarks are muttered at him for his appearance and manner, accusations of hailing from an upper class. "Now look where it's got you." He tries to shrug the words off and meet the glares with smiles. "Who am I trying to kid? I'm as scared as everyone else."
A young man locks eyes with Lale and pushes through the scrum of bodies towards him.
Some men shove him on his way through. "It's only your own space if you make it yours."
"How can you be so calm?" the young man says. "They had rifles. The bastards pointed rifles at us and forced us into this cattle train.
Lally smiles at him.
Not what I was expecting either. Where do you think we're going?
It doesn't matter. Just remember, we are here to keep our family safe at home.
But what if...
Don't what if. I don't know. You don't know. None of us knows. Let's just do as we're told.
Should we try and take them when we stop, since we outnumber them?
The young man's pale face is pinched with confused aggression. His balled-up hands box pathetically in front of him.
We have fists. They have rifles. Who do you think is going to win that fight?
The young man returns to silence. His shoulder is wedged into Lale's chest, and Lale can smell oil and sweat in his hair. His hands drop and hang limply by his side.
I'm Aaron,
he says.
Lale.
Others around them tune into their conversation, raising their heads towards the two men before lapsing back into silent reveries, sinking deep into their own thoughts. What they all share is fear. And youth. And their religion.
Lale tries to keep his mind off theorizing about what might lie ahead.
He's been told he's been taken to work for the Germans, and that is what he's planning to do. He thinks of his family back home, safe. He has made the sacrifice, has no regrets. He would make it again and again to keep his beloved family at home, together.
Every hour or so, it seems, people ask him similar questions. Wearying, Lale begins to answer.
Wait and see. He is perplexed as to why the questions are directed to him. He has no special knowledge. Yes, he wears a suit and tie, but that's the only visible difference between him and the next man.
We're all in the same filthy boat.
In the crowded wagon, they can't sit, let alone lie down. Two buckets substitute for toilets. As they fill, a fight breaks out as men try to get away from the stench. The buckets are knocked over, spilling their contents.
Lale clings to his suitcase, hoping that with the money and clothes he has, he might be able to buy himself out from wherever they are headed, or at the very least buy himself into a safe job.
Maybe there'll be work where I can use my languages.
He feels lucky to have found his way to the side of the wagon. Small gaps in the slats provide him with glimpses of the passing countryside. Snatched breaths of fresh air keep the rising tide of nausea at bay. It might be springtime, but the days are filled with rain and heavy cloud.
Occasionally they pass fields ablaze with spring flowers, and Lale smiles to himself.
Flowers. He learned from a young age, from his mother, that women love them. When would be the next time he could give a girl flowers? He takes them in, their brilliant colors flashing before his eyes, whole fields of poppies dancing in the breeze, a scarlet mass. He vows that the next flowers he gives to someone he will pick himself. It has never occurred to him that they grow wild in such large numbers. His mother had a few in her garden, but she never picked them and brought them inside. He starts a list in his head of things to do when I get home.
Another fight breaks out. Scuffling. Yells. Lale can't see what's going on, but he feels the squirming and pushing of bodies. Then there is silence. And from the gloom, the words,
"You've killed him!"
"Lucky bastard," someone mutters.
"Poor bastard. My life is too good to end in this stinkhole."
There are many stops on the journey, some lasting minutes, some hours, always outside a town or village.
Occasionally, Lale catches a glimpse of the station names as they speed through. Ostrava, a town he knows is close to the border of Czechoslovakia and Poland. Pszczyna, confirming they are then indeed in Poland. The unknown question, Where will they stop? Lale spends most of the time on the journey lost in thoughts about his life in Bratislava, his job, his apartment, his friends. His female friends in particular.
The train stops again. It is pitch black. Clouds block out the moon and stars completely. Does the dark portend their future? Things are as they are. What I can see, feel, hear, and smell right now. He sees only men like himself, young, and on a journey into the unknown. He hears the grumbling of empty stomachs and the rasping of dry windpipes. He smells piss and shit and the odor of bodies too long unwashed. The men take advantage of not being thrown around to rest without the need to push and shove for a piece of turf.
More than one head now rests on Lale.
Loud noises come from a few wagons back, gradually creeping closer. The men there have had enough and are going to attempt an escape. The sounds of men throwing themselves against the wooden sides of the wagon and the banging of what must be one of the ship buckets rouses everyone. Before long, every wagon erupts, attacked from within.
Help us or get out of the way!
A large man screams at Lale as he throws himself against the side.
Don't waste your energy, Lale replies.
If these walls were going to be breached, don't you think a cow would have done it by now? Several men stop their efforts, turning angrily towards him. They process his comment. The train lurches forward. Maybe those in charge have decided movement will stop the unrest. The wagons settle down.
Lale closes his eyes. Lale had returned to his parents' home in Krompachy, Slovakia,
following the news that Jews in small towns were being rounded up and transported to work for the Germans. He knew Jews were no longer allowed to work, and that their businesses had been confiscated. For nearly 4 weeks he helped around the house, fixing things with his father and brother, building new beds for his young nephews who had outgrown their cribs. His sister was the only family member earning an income as a seamstress. She had to travel to and from work in secret before dawn and after dark. Her boss was prepared to take the risk for her best employee. One evening, she returned home with a poster her boss had been asked to put in the shop window. It demanded that each Jewish family hand over a child aged 18 or older to work for the German government. The whispers, the rumors about what had been happening in other towns finally came to Krompachy. It seemed that the Slovakian government was acquiescing further to Hitler, giving him whatever he wanted. The poster warned, in bold type, that if any family had such a child and did not surrender them, the whole family would be taken to a concentration camp.
Max, Lale's older brother, immediately said he would go. But Lale would not hear of it. Max had a wife and two young children. He was needed at home. Lale reported to the local government department in Krompachy, offering himself for transportation. The officials he dealt with had been his friends. They'd gone to school together and knew each other's families. Lale was told to make his way to Prague, report to the appropriate authorities, and await further instructions.
After 2 days, the cattle train stops again. This time, there is a great commotion outside. Dogs are barking. Orders are yelled in German. Bolts are released. Wagon doors clang open.
Get down from the train, leave your possessions, shout the soldiers. Rush, rush, hurry up. Leave your things on the ground.
Being on the far side of the wagon, Lale is one of the last to leave.
Approaching the door, he sees the body of the man killed in the skirmish. Briefly closing his eyes, he acknowledges the man's death with a quick prayer. Then he leaves the wagon, but brings with him the stench, covering his clothes, his skin, every fiber of his being. Landing on bended knees, he puts his hands on the gravel and stays crouching for several moments, gasping, exhausted, painfully thirsty. Slowly rising, he looks around at the hundreds of startled men who are trying to comprehend the scene in front of them. Dogs snap and bite at those who are slow to move. Many stumble, the muscles in their legs refusing to work after days without use. Suitcases, bundles of books, meager possessions are snatched from those unwilling to surrender them or who simply don't understand the orders. They are then hit by a rifle or fist.
Lale studies the men in uniform, black and threatening. The twin lightning bolts on the collar of their jackets tell Lale who he's dealing with.
The SS. Under different circumstances, he might appreciate the tailoring, the fineness of the cloth, the sharpness of the cut. He places his suitcase on the ground. How will they know this one is mine? With a shiver, he realizes that it's unlikely he will see the case or its contents again. He touches his hand to his heart, to the money hidden in his jacket pocket. He looks to the heavens, breathes in the fresh, cool air, and reminds himself that at least he is outdoors.
A gunshot rings out and Lale jumps. Before him stands an SS officer, weapon pointed skywards.
Move!
Lale glances back at the emptied train.
Clothing blows away, and books flap open. Several trucks arrive and small boys clamber out. They snatch up the abandoned belongings and throw them into the trucks.
A heaviness settles between Lale's shoulder blades.
Sorry, Mama. They have your books.
The men trudge towards the looming dirty pink brick buildings with picture windows. Trees line the entrance, flush with new spring growth.
As Lale walks through open iron gates, he looks up at the German words wrought from the metal.
Arbeit macht frei. Work will make you free. He doesn't know where he is, or what work he is expected to do, but the idea that it will set him free has the feeling of a sick joke. SS, rifles, dogs, his belongings taken. This he'd been unable to imagine.
Where are we?
Lale turns to see Aaron at his side.
The end of the line, I'd say.
Aaron's face falls.
Just do as you're told, you'll be fine.
Lale knows he doesn't sound terribly convincing. He gives Aaron a quick smile, which is returned. Silently, Lale tells himself to take his own advice.
Do as you're told, and always observe.
Once inside the compound, the men are corralled into straight lines. At the head of Lale's row is an inmate with a beaten face sitting at a small table.
He wears a jacket and trousers of blue and white vertical stripes with a green triangle on his chest. Behind him stands an SS officer, rifle at the ready. Clouds roll in. Distant thunderclaps. The men wait. A senior officer, accompanied by an escort of soldiers, arrives at the front of the group. He has a square jaw, thin lips, and eyes hooded by bushy black brows. His uniform is plain in comparison to those guarding him. No lightning bolts. His demeanor shows that he is clearly the man in charge.
Welcome to Auschwitz.
Lale hears the words through a mouth that barely moves in disbelief.
Having been forced from his home and transported like an animal, now surrounded by heavily armed SS, he is now being welcomed. Welcomed.
I am Commandant Rudolf Huss. I am in charge here at Auschwitz. The gates you just walked through say, work will make you free. This is your first lesson. your only lesson. Work hard, do as you are told, and you will go free. Disobey and there will be consequences. You will be processed here and then you will be taken to your new home. Auschwitz too. Birkenau.
The commandant scans their faces. He begins to say something else but is interrupted by a large roll of thunder. He looks skyward, mutters a few words under his breath, flicks a dismissive hand at the men, and turns to walk away. The performance is over. His security presence hurries off after him, a clumsy display but still intimidating.
The processing begins. Lale watches as the first prisoners are shoved forward to the tables.
He's too far away to hear the short exchanges, can only watch as the seated men in pajamas write down details and hand each prisoner a small receipt.
Finally, it's Lale's turn.
He has to provide his name, address, occupation, and parents' names.
The weathered man at the table writes Lale's answers in a neat, looping script and passes him a piece of paper with a number on it. Throughout, the man never raises his head to meet Lale's eyes. Lale looks at the number. 32407.
He shuffles along with the flow of men towards another set of tables, where another group of striped prisoners bear the green triangle, and more SS stand by. His desire for water threatens to overwhelm him. Thirsty and exhausted, he is surprised when the piece of paper is yanked from his hand.
An SS officer pulls off Lale's jacket, rips his shirt sleeve and pushes his left forearm flat on the table.
He stares in disbelief as the numbers 32407 are stabbed into his skin, one after the other by the prisoner. The length of wood with a needle embedded in it moves quickly and painfully.
Then the man takes a rag dipped in green ink and rubs it roughly over Lale's wound. The tattooing has taken only seconds, but Lale's shock makes time stand still.
He grasps his arm, staring at the number. How can someone do this to another human being? He wonders if for the rest of his life, be it short or long, he will be defined by this moment, this irregular number, 32407.
A prod from the rifle butt breaks Lale's trance.
He collects his jacket from the ground and stumbles forward, following the men in front into a large brick building with bench seating along the walls. It reminds him of the gymnasium at the school in Prague, where he slept for 5 days before beginning his journey here.
Strip! Faster! Faster!
The SS bark out orders that the majority of the men cannot understand.
Lale translates for those nearby, who pass the word along.
Leave your clothes on the bench. They will be here after you've had your shower. Soon the group are removing trousers and shirts, jackets and shoes, folding their filthy clothes and placing them neatly on the benches.
Lale is cheered at the prospect of water, but knows he will probably not see his clothes again, nor the money inside them.
He takes off his clothes and places them on the bench, but outrage threatens to overwhelm him. From his trouser pocket, he removes a slim packet of matches, a reminder of past pleasures, and steals a glance at the nearest officer. The man is looking away.
Lale
strikes a match. This might be the final act of his own free will. He holds the match to the lining of his jacket, covers it with his trousers, and hurries to join the line of men at the showers. Behind him, within seconds, he hears screams of fire!
Lale looks back, sees naked men pushing and shoving to get away, as an SS officer attempts to beat out the flames.
He hasn't yet reached the showers, but finds himself shivering. What have I done? He's just spent several days telling everyone around him to keep their heads down, do as they're told, don't antagonize anyone. And now he's gone and lit a bloody fire inside a building. He has little doubt what would happen if someone pointed him out as the arsonist.
Stupid. Stupid.
In the shower block, he settles himself, breathes deeply. Hundreds of shivering men stand shoulder to shoulder as cold water rains down on them. They tilt their heads back and drink it in, desperately, despite its rankness. Many try to lessen their embarrassment by covering their genitals with their hands.
Lale washes the sweat, grime and stink from his body and hair.
Water hisses through the pipes and hammers the floor. When it ceases, the doors to the changing room reopen, and without command they walk back to what has now replaced their clothes. Old Russian army uniforms and boots.
Before you dress, you must visit the barber,
a smirking SS officer tells the men.
Outside. Hurry.
Once again, the men fall into lines. They move towards the prisoner standing ready with a razor.
When it's Lale's turn, he sits on the chair with his back straight and his head held high. He watches the SS officers walk the length of the line, assaulting the naked prisoners with the ends of their weapons, offering insults and cruel laughter. Lale sits straighter and lifts his head higher, as the hair on his head is reduced to stubble, not flinching when the razor nicks his scalp.
A shove in the back by an officer indicates that he is done. He follows the line back into the shower room, where he joins the search for clothing and wooden shoes of the right size. What is there is dirty and stained, but he manages to find shoes that more or less fit, and hopes the Russian uniform he grabs will do. Once dressed, he leaves the building as instructed. It's getting dark. He walks through the rain, one of countless men, for what seems like a long time. The thickening mud makes it difficult for him to lift his feet, but he trudges on determinedly. Some men struggle or fall to their hands and knees and are beaten until they get back up. If they do not, they are shot.
Lale tries to separate the heavy, sodden uniform from his skin. It rubs and chafes, and the smell of wet wool and dirt brings him back to the cattle train. Lale looks to the heavens, trying to swallow as much rain as he can.
The sweet taste is the best thing he's had in days. The only thing he's had in days. His thirst, compounding his weakness, blurring his vision. He gulps it down. Cupping his hands, he slurps wildly. In the distance, he sees spotlights surrounding a vast area. His semi-delirious state makes them seem like beacons, sparkling, dancing in the rain, showing him the way home. Calling, "Come to me. I will provide shelter, warmth and nourishment. Keep walking."
But as he walks through gates, these ones bearing no message, offering no deal, no promise of freedom in exchange for toil, Lale realizes the sparkling mirage has gone. He's in another prison.
Beyond this yard, disappearing into the darkness, is a further compound. The tops of the fences are lined with razor wire.
Up in the lookouts, Lale sees SS pointing rifles in his direction.
Lightning hits a fence nearby. They are electrified. The thunder is not loud enough to drown out the sound of a shot. Another man fallen.
"We made it."
Lale turns to see Aaron pushing his way towards him.
Drenched, bedraggled, but alive.
"Yeah, looks like we're home. You look a sight. You haven't seen yourself. Consider me a mirror." "No thanks." "What happens now?"
says Aaron, sounding like a child. Going with the steady flow of men, they each show their tattooed arm to an SS officer standing outside a building, who records the number on a clipboard.
After a forceful shove in the back, Lale and Aaron find themselves in Block 7,
a large hut with triple bunks down one wall. Dozens of men are forced into the building. They scramble and shove each other out of the way to lay claim to a space.
If they are lucky,
or aggressive enough, they might share with only one or two others. Luck isn't on Lale's side. He and Aaron climb up onto a top-level bunk, already occupied by two other prisoners.
Having had no food for days, there isn't much fight left in them.
As best he can, Lale curls up onto the straw-filled sack that passes for a mattress.
He pushes his hands against his stomach in an attempt to quell the cramps invading his guts. Several men call out to their guards,
"We need food."
The reply comes back,
"You'll get something in the morning."
"We'll all be dead from starvation by morning,"
says someone at the back of the block.
"And at peace,"
a hollow voice adds.
"These mattresses have got hay in them,"
someone else says.
"Maybe we should continue to act like cattle and eat that."
Snatches of quiet laughter. No response from the officer. And then, from deep in the dormitory, a hesitant
"Moo."
Laughter. Quiet, but real. The officer, present but invisible, doesn't interrupt, and eventually the men fall asleep, stomachs rumbling.
It's still dark when Lale wakes, needing to take a piss.
He scrambles over his sleeping companions down to the floor and feels his way to the back of the block, thinking it might be the safest place to relieve himself. Approaching, he hears voices, Slovak and German. He is relieved to see that there are facilities, albeit crude, for them to shit. Long ditches run behind the building with planks of wood placed over them. Three prisoners are sitting across the ditch, shitting and talking quietly to each other. From the other end of the building,
Lale sees two SS approaching in the semi-darkness, smoking, laughing, their rifles hung loosely down their backs. The flickering perimeter floodlights make disturbing shadows of them, and Lale can't make out what they are saying. His bladder is full, but he hesitates.
In unison, the officers flick their cigarettes up into the air, whip their rifles around, and open fire. The bodies of the three who were taking a shit are thrown back into the ditch.
Lale's breath catches in his throat.
He presses his back against the building as the officers pass him. He catches the profile of one of them. A boy. Just a bloody kid.
As they disappear into the darkness, Lale makes a vow to himself.
"I will live to leave this place. I will walk out a free man. If there is a hell, I will see these murderers burn in it." He thinks of his family back in Krumpachi, and hopes that his presence here is at least saving them from a similar fate.
Lale relieves himself and returns to his bunk.
"The shots,"
says Aaron.
"What were they?"
"I didn't see."
Aaron swings his leg over Lale on his way to the ground.
"Where are you going?" "A piss."
Lale reaches to the side of the bed, clutches Aaron's hand.
"Hold on." "Why?"
"You heard the shots," says Lale.
"Just hold on until the morning."
Aaron says nothing as he clambers back into bed and lies down, his two fists curled against his crotch in fear and defiance. His father had been picking up a customer from the train station.
Mr. Scheinberg prepared to lift himself elegantly into the carriage as Lale's father placed his fine leather luggage on the seat opposite.
Where had he travelled from? Prague? Bratislava? Vienna, perhaps?
Wearing an expensive woolen suit, his shoes freshly shined, he smiled and spoke briefly to Lale's father as he climbed up front. His father encouraged the horse to move on. Like most of the other men, Lale's father ferried around with his taxi service. Mr. Scheinberg was returning home from important business. Lale wanted to be like him, rather than like his father.
Mr. Scheinberg did not have his wife with him that day.
Lale loved to glimpse Mrs. Scheinberg. and the other women who travelled in his father's carriages, their small hands encased in white gloves, their elegant pearl earrings matching their necklaces.
He loved the beautiful women in fine clothing and jewels who sometimes accompanied the important men. The only advantage of helping his father came from opening the carriage door for them, taking their hand as he assisted them down, inhaling their scent, dreaming of the lives they led. Chapter 2.
Outside! Everyone outside!
Whistles blow and dogs bark. Sunlight from a clear morning streams through the door into Block 7. The men disentangle themselves from each other, climb down from their bunks and shuffle outside. They stand around just outside the building. No one is prepared to move too far away. They wait. And wait. Those who were shouting and blowing whistles have disappeared. The men shuffle their feet back and forth, whisper to the person nearest them. Looking over at other blocks, they see the same scene being played out. What now? Wait. Eventually, an SS officer and a prisoner approach Block 7, which falls silent. No introductions are made. The prisoner calls out numbers from a clipboard. The SS officer stands alongside, tapping his foot impatiently, slapping his thigh with his swagger stick. It takes a moment for the prisoners to realize that the numbers relate to the tattoos they each bear on their left arm. When the roll call is over, two numbers have received no response.
You!
The roll caller points to a man on the end of the row.
Go back inside and see if anyone's still there!
The man looks at him with questioning eyes. He hasn't understood a word. The man beside him whispers the instruction, and he hurries inside. A few moments later he returns, holds up his right hand and extends his index and middle finger. Two dead.
The SS officer steps forward. He speaks in German. The prisoners have learned already to keep their mouths shut and stand obediently waiting, hoping some among them will be able to translate. Lale gets it all.
You will have two meals a day, one in the morning and one in the evening, if you survive until evening.
He pauses, a grim smile on his face.
After your morning meal, you will work until we tell you to stop. You will continue with the construction of this camp. We have many more people to transport here.
His smile becomes a proud grin.
Follow the instructions of your capo and those in charge of the building program, and you will see the sun go down.
There is a sound of clanging metal, and the prisoners turn to see a group of men approaching, carrying two cauldrons and armfuls of small metal tins. Breakfast. A few prisoners start to head towards the smaller group, as though to offer assistance.
If anyone moves, they will be shot,
barks the SS officer, raising his rifle.
There will be no second chances.
The officer leaves, and the prisoner who conducted the roll call addresses the group.
You heard him,
says the man, in Polish-accented German.
I am your capo, your boss. You will form two lines to get your food. Anyone complaining will suffer consequences.
The men jockey into line, and several start whispering among themselves, asking if anyone has understood what the German said.
Lale tells those nearest to him and asks them to pass it along. He will translate as much as he can.
As he reaches the front of the line, he gratefully accepts a small tin cup, its contents slopping over the rough hands that thrust it at him. He steps aside and examines his meal. It is brown, contains nothing solid, and has a smell he cannot identify. It is neither tea, coffee, nor soup. He fears he will bring the foul liquid back up if he drinks it slowly, so he closes his eyes, pinches his nostrils with his fingers, and gulps it down. Others are not so successful. Aaron, standing nearby, raises his cup in a mock toast.
Oh, I got a piece of potato. What about you?
Best meal I've had in ages.
Are you always so upbeat?
Ask me again at the end of the day,
Lale says with a wink.
Returning his empty cup to the prisoner who handed it to him,
Lale thanks him with a quick nod and half a smile.
The capo shouts,
When you lazy bastards have finished your dining, get back into line, you have work to do.
Lale passes on the instruction.
You'll follow me,
the capo shouts.
And you'll follow the instructions of the foreman. Any slacking off, I'll know about it.
Lale and the others find themselves in front of a partially erected building, a replica of their own block.
Other prisoners are already there, carpenters and bricklayers all quietly labouring in the established rhythm of people used to working together.
You! Yes, you! Get up on the roof! You can work up there!
The command is directed at Lale.
Looking around, he spies a ladder going up to the roof. Two prisoners squat there waiting to receive the tiles which are being shuttled up to them.
The two men move aside as Lale clambers up.
The roof consists only of wooden beams for supporting the tiles.
Be careful, one of the workmen warns him. Move further up the roof line and watch us. It's not difficult, you'll soon get the hang of it.
The man is Russian.
My name's Lale.
Introductions later, okay?
The two men exchange a look. You understand me?
Yes, Lale replies in Russian. The men smile. Lale watches as they receive the heavy clay tiles from the pair of hands poking over the lip of the roof, crawl to where the last tiles were laid and carefully overlap them before moving back to the ladder for the next one. The Russian had been correct. It's not difficult work. And it isn't long before Lale joins them in accepting and laying the tiles. On the warm spring day, only the hunger pains and cramps prevent him from matching the more experienced workers. A few hours pass before they are permitted to take a break. Lale heads for the ladder, but the Russian stops him.
It's safer to stay up here and rest. You can't be seen well this high up.
Lale follows the men, who clearly know the best place to sit and stretch out. The corner where stronger timber was used to reinforce the roof. How long have you been here? Lale asks as soon as they settle down.
About 2 months, I think. Hard to tell after a while.
Where did you come from? I mean, how did you end up here? Are you Jewish?
One question at a time,
the Russian chuckles. And the younger, larger worker rolls his eyes at the ignorance of the newcomer, yet to learn his place in the camp.
We are not Jewish. We are Russian soldiers. We got separated from our unit and the fucking Germans caught us and put us to work. What about you? A Jew?
Yes. I'm part of a large group brought in yesterday from Slovakia. All Jews.
The Russians exchange a glance. The older man turns away, closing his eyes, raising his face to the sun, leaving it to his companion to continue the conversation. Look around. You can see from up here how many blocks are being built and how much land they have to keep clearing.
Lale pushes himself onto his elbows and observes the vast area contained within the electrified fence.
Blocks, like the one he's helping to construct, stretch out into the distance. He experiences a jolt of horror at what this place might become. He wrestles with what to say next, not wanting to give voice to his distress. He settles back down, turning his head away from his companions, desperate to bring his emotions under control. He must trust no one, reveal little about himself, be cautious. The man watches him closely. He says,
I've heard the SS boasting that this is going to be the biggest concentration camp of all.
Is that right? Says Lale, forcing his voice above a whisper.
Well, if we're going to build it together, you might as well tell me your name.
Andor, he says. And this big oaf with me is Boris. He doesn't say much.
Dorgin can get you killed here,
Boris mutters as he stretches his hand out to Lale. What else can you tell me about the people here? Says Lale. And who the hell are these capos?
You will tell them,
says Boris, yawning.
Well, there are other Russian soldiers like us, but not many, and then there are all the different triangles.
Like the green triangle my capo wears, Lale says.
Andor laughs.
Oh, the greens are the worst. They're criminals. Killers, rapists, that kind of men. They make good guards because they're terrible people.
He continues.
Others are here because of their anti-German political views. They wear a red triangle. You'll see a few, not many, with a black triangle. They are lazy bastards and they don't last long. And finally, there is you and your friends.
We wear the yellow star.
Yes, you wear the star. Your crime is to be Jewish.
Why don't you have a color? Asks Lale. Andor shrugs.
We're just the enemy.
Boris snorts.
They insult us by sharing our uniforms with the rest of you. They can't do much worse than that.
A whistle blows and the three men get back to work. That night, the men in Block 7 gather in small groups to talk, share what they've learned, and question. Several move to the far end of the hut where they offer prayers to their god. These mingle into something unintelligible.
Are they praying for guidance, vengeance, acceptance? It seems to Lale that, without a rabbi to guide them, each man prays for what is most important to him.
And he decides this is as it should be. He moves between the groups of men, listening, but taking no part.
By the end of his first day, Lale has exhausted the knowledge of his two Russian co-workers.
For the rest of the week, he heeds his own advice, keeps his head down, does what he is asked, never argues. At the same time, he observes everyone and everything going on around him. It is clear to him, looking at the design of the new buildings, that the Germans lack any architectural intelligence. Whenever possible, he listens to the talk and gossip of the SS, who don't know he understands them. They give him ammunition of the only sort available to him. Knowledge. To be stored up for later. The SS stand around most of the day, leaning against walls, smoking, keeping only one eye on things. By eavesdropping, he learns that Camp Commandant Hues is a lazy bastard who hardly ever shows his face, and that accommodation for Germans at Auschwitz is superior to that at Birkenau, which has no access to cigarettes or beer.
One group of workers stands out to Lale. They keep to themselves, wear civilian clothes, and speak to the SS without fearing for their safety. Lale determines to find out who these men are.
Other prisoners never pick up a piece of wood or tile, but instead walk casually around the compound on other business. His capo is one such.
How to get a job like that?
Such a position would offer the best chance to find out what is going on in the camp, what the plans are for Birkenau, and more importantly, for him.
Lale is on the roof, tiling in the sun, when he spies his capo heading in their direction. Come on, you lazy bastards! Work faster! Lale yells. We've got a block to finish! He continues barking orders as the capo appears below. Lale has made a habit of acknowledging him with a deferential nod of the head.
On one occasion he received a short nod back. He has spoken to him in Polish. At the least, his capo has accepted him as a subservient prisoner who will not cause problems.
With a half smile, the capo makes eye contact with Lale and beckons him down from the roof. Lale approaches him with his head bowed.
Do you like what you're doing on the roof? Says the capo.
I'll do whatever I am told to do, replies Lale.
But everyone wants an easier life, yes?
Lale says nothing.
I need a boy, Acapo says, playing with the fraying edge of his Russian army shirt. It's too big for him, chosen to make the little man appear larger and more powerful than those he must control.
From his gap-toothed mouth, Lale experiences the pungent smell of partially digested meat.
You will do whatever I ask you to. Bring me my food, clean my boots, and you must be beside me whenever I want you. Do this and I can make life easier for you. Fail me, and there will be consequences.
Lale stands beside his capo, as his answer to the job offer. He wonders if by moving from builder to dog's body, he is making a deal with the devil. On a beautiful spring day, not too hot, Lale watches as a large enclosed truck continues past the usual point for unloading building supplies. It drives around the back of the administration building. Lale knows that the boundary fence lies not far beyond, and he has never dared venture to this area. But curiosity gets the better of him now.
He walks after it with an air of, I belong here. I can go where I want. He peers around the corner at the back of the building. The truck pulls up beside an odd bus. It has been adapted into a bunker of sorts, with steel plates nailed across the window frames.
Lale watches as dozens of naked men are herded out of the truck and led towards the bus.
Some enter willingly. Those who resist are hit by a rifle butt. Fellow prisoners drag the semi-conscious objectors to their fate. The bus is so full that the last men to board cling to the steps with their tiptoes, their naked bottoms hanging out the door. Officers shove their weight against the bodies. Then the doors are slammed shut. One officer walks around the bus, rapping on the metal sheets, checking everything is secure. A nimble officer clambers onto the roof with a canister in his hand.
Unable to move, Lale watches as he opens a small hatch on the roof of the bus and upends the canister.
Then he slams the lid down and latches it. As the guard scurries down, the bus shakes violently and muffled screams are heard.
Lale drops to his knees, retching. He remains there, sick in the dirt, as the screams fade.
When the bus is still and quiet, the doors are opened. Dead men fall out like blocks of stone. A group of prisoners is marched out from beyond the other corner of the building. The truck backs up, and the prisoners begin transferring the bodies onto it, staggering under the weight while trying to hide their distress.
Lale has witnessed an unimaginable act. He staggers to his feet, standing on the threshold of hell, an inferno of feelings raging inside him.
The next morning he cannot rise. He is burning up.
It takes 7 days for Lale to regain consciousness. Someone is pouring water gently into his mouth. He registers a cool, damp rag on his forehead.
There, boy, says a voice. Take it easy.
Lale opens his eyes to see a stranger, an older man, peering gently into his face.
He pushes himself up onto his elbows and the stranger supports him to sit. He looks around, confused.
What day is it? Where is he? The fresh air might do you good,
says the man, taking Lale's elbow.
He is escorted out into a cloudless day, one that seems made for joy, and he shivers at the memory of the last day like this. His world spins and he staggers. The stranger supports him, leading him to a nearby pile of timber.
Pulling up Lale's sleeve, he points to the tattooed number.
My name is Beban. I am the Tetoviera. What do you think of my handiwork?
Tetoviera? Says Lale,
You mean you did this to me?
Pepin shrugs, looks Lale directly in the eye.
I wasn't given a choice.
Lale shakes his head. This number wouldn't have been my first choice of tattoo.
What would you have preferred?
Asks Pepin. Lale smiles slyly.
What's her name?
My sweetheart. I don't know. We haven't met yet.
Pepin chuckles.
The two men sit in companionable silence. Lale
traces a finger over his numbers.
What's your accent? Says Lale.
I am French.
And what happened to me? Lale asks finally.
Die for us. You are destined for an early grave.
Lale shudders.
Then why am I sitting here with you?
I was walking past your block just as your body was being thrown onto a cart for the dead and dying. A young man was pleading with the SS to leave you, saying that he would take care of you. When they went into the next block, he pushed you off the cart and started dragging you back inside. I went and helped him.
How long ago was this?
7, 8 days. Since then, the men in your block have looked after you during the night. I've spent as much time as I can during the day caring for you. How do you feel?
I feel okay. I don't know what to say. How to thank you.
Thank the man who pushed you from the cart. It was his courage that held you back from the jaws of death.
I will when I find out who it was. Do you know?
No, I'm sorry, we didn't exchange names.
Lale closes his eyes for a few moments, letting the sun warm his skin, giving him the energy, the will to go on.
He lifts his sagging shoulders, and resolve seeps back into him. He is still alive. He stands on shaking legs, stretching, trying to breathe new life back into an ailing body in need of rest, nourishment, and hydration. Sit down. You're still very weak.
Conceding the obvious, Lale does so. Only now his back is straighter, his voice firmer. He gives Pepin a smile. The old Lale is back, almost as hungry for information as he is for food.
I see you wear a red star, he says.
Ah, yes. I was an academic in Paris, and was too outspoken for my own good.
What did you teach?
Economics.
And being a teacher of economics got you here? How?
Well, Lale,
a man who lectures on taxation and interest rates can't help but get involved in the politics of his country. Politics will help you understand the world until you don't understand it anymore, and then it will get you thrown into a prison camp. Politics and religion both.
And will you go back to that life when you leave here?
An optimist. I don't know what my future holds. Or yours.
No crystal ball, then?
No, indeed. Through the noise of construction, dogs barking, and guards shouting, Pepin leans forward and asks,
Are you as strong in character as you are physically?
Lale returns Pepin's gaze.
I'm a survivor.
Your strength can be a weakness, given the circumstances we find ourselves in. Charm and an easy smile will get you in trouble.
I am a survivor.
Well, then maybe I can help you survive in here.
You have friends in high places.
Pepin laughs and slaps Lale on the back.
No. No friends in high places. Like I told you, I am a tetoviera. And I have been told the number of people coming here will be increasing very soon.
They sit with the thought for a moment. What lodges in Lale's mind is that somewhere, someone is making decisions, plucking numbers from...
Where?